From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Joyce Johnson talks about her relationship with Jack Kerouac. They met in 1957 when Kerouac was broke and not yet famous. The two became lovers and were together when On the Road was published, and he suddenly found himself hailed as the king of the beats. Johnson's book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Kerouac wrote to each other during their two-year relationship. It's just out in paperback. Also, we look back on the life and music of the late alto saxophonist Art Pepper with his widow, Lori Pepper. She co-wrote his autobiography and has just produced a box set of his Hollywood All-Star Sessions. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Our Song. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush is in Warsaw, Poland today. He called for a more unified Europe and congratulated Poland for its move to democracy from communism. Mr. Bush will meet Russian President Vladimir Putin tomorrow for the first time in Slovenia. The two leaders differ sharply on defense issues. Mr. Bush wants to build a missile defense shield for the U.S. Putin is concerned about that because it would mean scrapping the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty. More violence is reported in Gothenburg, Sweden, where a summit of European Union leaders is underway. The city is littered with glass and bricks, the result of clashes between anti-globalization protesters and police. One demonstrator was reportedly shot and wounded in the unrest. The BBC's James Rogers reports from Gothenburg.
Gothenburg police say that one of their officers drew his gun, then shot and wounded a demonstrator. A hospital spokesman in Gothenburg is quoted as saying that two people are being treated for gunshot wounds. Television pictures showed a policeman with a riot shield brandishing a handgun. The Swedish police had long expected demonstrations during the EU summit, but no one had anticipated the violence which unfolded. On the first morning of this meeting of Europe's leaders, hundreds of anti-capitalist demonstrators attempt to march on the conference hall where the summit is being held. The police managed to hold them back, but not before they had been subject to a hail of rocks and fireworks. Following the disturbances, EU leaders were forced to remain in the conference hall rather than leave for a dinner.
The BBC's James Rogers reporting from Gothenburg, Sweden. Members of the Senate Commerce Committee have warned officials in Illinois to solve air traffic congestion problems in the skies over Chicago, or Congress will do it for them. Chris Lehman of member station WNIJ has the details.
Suggestions include building additional runways at O'Hare Airport, more use of regional airports, and construction of an entirely new airport about 40 miles south of downtown Chicago. Ranking Republican John McCain says the only thing that is not an option is inaction on the part of state and local officials.
Well, I'm reluctant, extremely reluctant, to interfere with local and regional decision-making in this area. Failure to act could force the federal government to become involved in this situation.
McCain says congestion at O'Hare is a national problem. Illinois Governor George Ryan and Chicago Mayor Richard Daley have long differed on how to address the issue. For NPR News, I'm Chris Lehman in Chicago.
Stocks fell today, driving the three major indices to seven-week lows. Investors continued to mark down prices with each wave of bad news about eroding corporate profits. The Dow Industrials lost 66 points and closed at 10,623 in very heavy trading of 1.5 billion shares. The Nasdaq fell 15 to finish at 2028. This is NPR News. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will meet with Palestinian and Israeli leaders tomorrow to help strengthen a U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal. After meeting with Lebanese leaders today in Beirut, Annan told reporters he's glad to see a ceasefire in place, but he added it will not last unless both sides see it as part of a broader peace negotiation strategy. A Democratic congressman is asking White House political adviser Karl Rove to explain a policy meeting that Rove had with executives of the Intel Corporation. The meeting took place in March when Rove held more than $100,000 worth of stock in the computer chip maker. NPR's Peter Overby has more on that story.
California Democrat Henry Waxman is asking Rove to clarify some questions. When Rove met with the Intel executives, the company was lobbying for government approval of a merger for one of its suppliers. The merger was approved 2 months later, presumably helping Intel's business and its stock. The White House says Rove reacted appropriately when the issue came up. He told the executives they should be talking to other agencies. An Intel spokesman says the executives don't remember Rove having any specific reaction to their pitch. Rove sold off his stock portfolio last week. Waxman wants to know what Rove said at the meeting and if he's had White House meetings with executives of other companies he invested in. A White House spokeswoman said the letter is under review. She said people are tired of these kinds of fishing expeditions. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
The Navy is assembling a committee to investigate new sites for bombing practice. President Bush has ordered abandonment of the island of Vieques by spring 2003. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America on the web at SodexoMarriott.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Joyce Johnson met Jack Kerouac in 1957 through their mutual friend Allen Ginsberg. Johnson and Kerouac were lovers for nearly 2 years. When they met, Johnson was 21 years old. Kerouac was 35 and not yet famous. But while they were together, his novel On the Road was published, and he was transformed into the spokesperson of the Beats. Much of the time that Johnson and Kerouac were lovers, he was traveling or living in another city while she stayed in Manhattan. During those times, they communicated through letters. The letters they wrote each other are published in Johnson's book Door Wide Open, which has just been published in paperback. Johnson is also the author of an earlier memoir called Minor Characters, focusing on the period when she knew Kerouac. But she couldn't quote from his letters in that book because Kerouac's widow withheld permission. And it wasn't until 1998 that his estate sent her copies of the letters she had written to him. Last year, when Door Wide Open was published in hardcover, I asked Johnson what first attracted her to Kerouac.
He was the most unusual person I'd ever met. He had an incredible memory. He told great stories. He'd had amazing adventures. And he had a kind of sweetness and melancholy about him that were also very, very appealing. And an ability to take a lot of pleasure in small, everyday things. You know, if I made him a bowl of Lipton's pea soup, I was a great cook. He totally charmed me when I met him.
Now, you met him through Allen Ginsberg, and shortly after you met, he was off on his travels again. And
yeah.
One of the early letters in your book is when he sent you from Tangiers, and I'd like you to read an excerpt of it.
Sure. This was in early March 1957. He wrote it just as he was nearing the coast of Africa. He'd been on a freighter called the SS Slovenia for about a month. All during the trip, I ate alone at a huge white tablecloth with one mysterious Yugoslavian woman, Mata Hari. We had a dangerous storm 500 miles out and almost foundered. In all my years as a seaman, I never saw my ship bury its nose in mountain waves and plunge up into other valleys like a rowboat. It was awful. We had to flee south and lose a day. During this ordeal, I heard the words, "Everything is God. Nothing ever happened except God." And I believed and still do. Kierkegaard and the storm together made me see this luminous, peaceful truth.
Now, I found your response to his letter so interesting because here he is, you know, traveling around the world, having these, like, grand adventures. And you're, you know, working in New York and trying to deal with, like, your life versus his life and how different they seemed. Read us an excerpt of your response to him.
Okay. I've thought a lot about your letter, about your finding God in the middle of the storm. I can't really comprehend that. I want you to know that about me. I scramble from day to day, hour to hour, and I seldom stop to ask questions. Because when I do, I find everything in the world senseless, without reason, and it terrifies me. I'm not defending myself. I'm simply telling you this. I look at your way with wonder, but there's nothing I can say to you about it except that. And in the meanwhile, I move 2 miles downtown to a new job, not too different from the old one, and you move across the ocean to another continent.
In a way, while he's having this big adventure, you know, going to Northern Africa, your adventure is in part being with him, knowing him.
Absolutely. That was a big adventure for me. But also my adventure... as it turned out, was also being in New York in that whole wonderful period and discovering all these very, very gifted people who are all converging on downtown Manhattan, painters, poets, photographers, actors. It was sort of an amazing scene. It was a very, very good time to be in New York.
You know, although Kerouac sounds really excited and invigorated in the first letter he sends you, his letters start to sound more depressed not long after that. Let me ask you to read an excerpt of this March 1957 letter.
There are many dull expatriate characters here I try to avoid mostly. Not too many good vibrations in Tangier. And the Arabs, very quiet, send out no vibrations at all. So I spend most of my time musing in my room. Somehow can't write here, but anyway, that can wait. What I'm actually doing is thinking nostalgic thoughts of Frisco. Not too interested in this old world scene, as though I'd seen it before, plenty. Anyway, in early April, I'm off by myself to Paris. The others can join me later to get cheap garret. Then London, Dublin, Brittany. Then I try to get job on freighter, work my way back this summer. I just don't seem interested. Got too much to do in America. Shouldn't have come at all, of course. So I'll likely be seeing you in New York, in July maybe. Look forward to seeing you. Lonely here. Don't like whores anyway, and no girls speak English. Mostly fags abound in this sinister international hive of queens. I've had everything in the books, smoked opium, ate hashish. Don't want any of it. Just musing in my room. Lights out, face sea, moon, liquid lights of anchored ships and bay. Good enough.
How did it make you feel to have him complaining about the whores?
Well, it certainly made me feel weird. It was as though he'd forgotten that I was his girlfriend, you know, and it sounded as though he was writing to one of his buddies. I didn't know what to make of it.
Were you surprised that here he was in this place that he'd worked so hard to get to, and he didn't like being there, and he was saying maybe he shouldn't have come at all, and he was telling you all these other places he's going to go to, and sounding very depressed?
Well, I was surprised because he had really been looking forward to this trip immensely and planned to spend many months in Tangier and then spend a good part of the next year traveling in Europe. But I soon learned that this was sort of a pattern of Jack's. You know, he would, before he went to a place, he would fantasize about it and think that it was going to be wonderful and the solution to all his problems. And then he'd get there, and inevitably the bad vibrations would set in, because wherever he went, he took his troubles with him. And I think by that time in his life, there was no place in the world where he could really be happy or comfortable. Nothing worked for him.
In the letters, he always seems to want to be in the place that he wasn't.
That's right, to see something new and strange.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how that affected you. For instance, I mean, he'd invite you to come and be with him in San Francisco, and then he'd write and tell you he was leaving for Mexico. He'd invite you to Mexico, and then he'd decide, no, he had to go to New York. And so you were always having to change your plans.
Well, it certainly complicated my life immensely, and it was very disappointing because I wanted so much to travel myself. And I also, you know, had to take steps in order to prepare myself to travel, such as giving up my job or saving money or giving up my apartment. So I had a very complicated summer, the summer of 1957, when I was thinking first that I would join Jack in San Francisco and then later in Mexico City. I was particularly disappointed about not going to Mexico City. He had gotten the Asiatic flu in Mexico City and was going back to Orlando, Florida, and from there he planned to come to New York in time for the publication of On the Road. He thought it might be kind of interesting to be around for it.
And
he
was
had absolutely no notion of what awaited him.
Right. Well, he was around for it. In fact, he was staying with you at your apartment the day
right.
that famous review by Gilbert Milstein came out in the New York Times. Would you describe what it was like to go with him at midnight to the newsstand and pick up this review that basically made him a star overnight?
Well, it was nothing that Jack was prepared for. I mean, he could barely sort of take it in. It compared him in his importance to F. Scott Fitzgerald. Milstein said what Fitzgerald was to the Lost Generation, Kerouac would be to the Beat Generation, and he made him the spokesman for a whole generation. He kept reading it and sort of shaking his head and saying, "Well, I think it's pretty good. What do you think?" And I say, "Yeah, it's really good." And then the next day, the phone started ringing and never stopped.
Not all the reviews were positive, like Truman Capote.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, describe some of the bad reviews.
Well, I would say by and large, the reviews On the Road got were hostile, humiliating, and very insulting things were said about On the Road. For example, Truman Capote said, "This isn't writing, this is typing." I mean, I can't think of any American writer who endured such consistent abuse from critics and reviewers all through his career. And it was very, very devastating for him.
How did he take the bad reviews?
They made him very depressed. Of course, he had a tendency to be depressed. And the only way he seemed to be able to get himself through this period was to step up his drinking, which was already pretty heavy.
Soon after that review in the New York Times, he left New York. And soon after he left, you wrote a letter to your friend Elise, and I'd like you to excerpt that letter.
"I dig ironing his shirts, cooking for him, etc. It's funny. It's not at all romantic anymore, but it doesn't matter. I love him. Don't mind playing mama, since that's what he seems to want me to be. I may go down to see him in Orlando. I've gotten kind of a left-handed backwards invitation. His mother seems to want me to come. There's no doubt in my mind anymore that Mama is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense."
Now, when you said it's not that romantic anymore, what did you mean?
I found myself in the position of almost having to take care of Jack to kind of get him through this whole experience that he was coping with so badly. And it was a very unfamiliar role for me. I was only 21. But I thought, you know, he would get through the difficulties of this period and come out of it. But that's really not what happened.
How did you feel being in this really unconventional relationship, yet expected to do very conventional things for Kerouac, like cooking and ironing and taking him home when he got too drunk?
Well, you know, everything seemed so crazy. We were living such a strange life that it was almost a relief to iron a shirt. It was sort of quiet and familiar. You know, everything that was sort of quiet and familiar and homelike had gotten to seem sort of exotic to me because the life we were living was so strange.
Now, in this letter that you just read an excerpt of, you said that there's no doubt that his mother is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
It became apparent to me that Jack really had not separated from his mother. He was overly attached to his mother. You know, he planned to settle down and live with her, which was something that was very hard for me to understand, that she had too much of a hold on him for his own good.
Was it her trying to have a hold on him, or was it him wanting to be with her?
Well, it worked both ways. I mean, she wanted to keep him with her, and so that any young woman who came into his life was considered the enemy, someone who had to be fended off or driven off. At the same time, she had always been a source of refuge for him during those years when he was very broke and obscure and wandering around the United States and virtually homeless. She provided a base for him, a place where he could come and crash and write another book and keep his manuscripts and his letters. So I think without his Jack's mother, we might have had fewer Kerouac novels. She was important to him in that way, in a good way. But her emotional hold on him was very crippling for Jack.
My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other during the 2 years they were lovers. How did fame agree with him?
of fame did not agree with him very well at all. Part of the problem was he didn't become famous in the way that he would have liked to have become famous. I think what he really had dreamed of was having a real, you know, a literary success, which would have been much quieter, for one thing. But instead of that, he found himself the spokesperson for the Beat Generation, and this was not a role that he felt at all comfortable with. It was something Allen Ginsberg, of course, could have played to the hilt. But Jack was not very, very good at facing the public. He was basically a shy, rather naive guy about the whole business, and it was very difficult for him being on television and so on. It was frightening for him, and it made him feel that he didn't know who he was anymore.
Now, you say that after he became famous, there was a pack of predatory women that invaded your lives. What was it like watching all of these women flirting with Jack Kerouac?
Oh, of course, I hated it, and it made me furious. It was as though I didn't exist at all. Suddenly, there was this swarm of women around him. He was such a celebrity and so attractive, and right in front of me, these women were throwing themselves at Jack. It was very unpleasant to watch.
You say that during this period, everyone wanted to give him pills or buy him drinks. He already had a drinking problem. Did it get worse?
It did get much worse. I think he felt that he had to live up to an image of himself that people had, that they didn't really expect to see someone like Jack Kerouac, who was a fairly quiet guy, kind of an observer. They expected to see someone very extroverted, like the Dean Moriarty character in his novel. So the only way he could approximate that character was to get very loaded.
And did he become more like Dean Moriarty when he did become loaded?
He became much, much more extroverted and outgoing, mm-hmm. and talked more.
Now, you said that you grew up in a house without any alcohol, with the exception of Manischewitz Passover wine.
Right.
Were there things you didn't understand about his drinking?
Yeah, I really didn't understand about his drinking. I thought that if Jack could just sort of get through this period and settle down and maybe have a real home somewhere, he could sort of straighten himself out. And he kept wanting to stop drinking, and he would make attempts even during this period. And in order to stop drinking, he would we'd basically take the phone off the hook and stay shut up in the house for a week. He always seemed a different person in a way when he'd stopped drinking for a while, and then his innate sweetness would come out.
How did you and Kerouac end up breaking up?
We went out to dinner. This was in October of 1958 with a bunch of artists we knew, and right before my eyes, Jack was flirting outrageously with a woman whom I knew was very interested in him, and I could sort of see the handwriting on the wall, and I'd seen this kind of thing one too many times, and I just couldn't stand it, so I asked Jack to come outside the restaurant with me, and I told him I couldn't bear it and that it was the end. I said to him, because it was the only thing I could think of, "You're nothing but a big bag of wind."
What was his reaction when you told him you couldn't take it anymore?
He said, I told you, I don't like blondes. Unrequited love's a bore. You know, it was though we were shouting nonsense at each other. And then he stomped off into the restaurant, and I went up the block, and that was it.
So that was really it?
That was it. It ended very abruptly.
How did he describe you in Desolation Angels?
As middle class, sad, and looking for something.
He also wrote, "Perhaps the best love affair I ever had."
Right, and he said that I had me a companion there. And I think that was a very important thing to Jack, the fact that we were both writers. And a lot of the things we wrote to each other were about our writing. And this was a novelty for him, to have a woman in his life who was as interested in writing as he was.
You say in your new book that you've had to protect your memories from being swamped by Kerouac's legend. What are some parts of the legend that don't fit with your memories?
Well, the idea that Jack was such a free spirit, you know, mainly, that this big example of freedom, or this, you know, or that he was this great Buddhist, those things. Because, you know, although he certainly did go on the road, and you know, deep inside him, he wasn't free at all. He was so knotted up and so so miserable and so attached to his mother. And Buddhism was something that was very important to Jack, and he it was one of those things he looked to find some solution to what troubled him. But he really misused it, even though he had a profound intellectual understanding of it. He used Buddhism to sort of rationalize all his problems and you know, what was the point of dealing with them since we're all going to die anyway?
What did you think a few years ago of the Gap campaign of, you know, Kerouac wore khakis?
One thing that amused me very much about that campaign was there was a picture of Jack wearing khakis in a photo shoot. It was an old photo that had been taken for Pageant magazine. A photographer had followed Jack and me around the village for a night, and I was airbrushed out of it as though I had never existed.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So you saw that photo without you on
that's right.
On yeah. Buses and
that's right.
Posters
that's right.
All over.
And
oh,
I knew
really
there was
funny.
A ghost there. Yeah.
Oh gosh. Well, that's so perfect, because your first book was called Minor Characters.
It's called exactly.
And
exactly.
All about how the women were relegated to the status of minor character in the
yeah.
Beat story. Oh, that's so funny. Joyce Johnson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Joyce Johnson's book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote each other. The book has just been published in paperback. Our interview was recorded last year after it was published in hardcover. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Flags of Our Fathers by James Bradley with Ron Powers, stories of the men who raised the American flag at Iwo Jima during World War II. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Lori Pepper talks about living with a gifted but self-destructive jazz musician, her late husband, Art Pepper. She's just produced a box set of his Hollywood All-Star Sessions. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Our Song. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In spite of his self-destructive instincts, alto saxophonist Art Pepper managed to leave behind an impressive body of recordings before he died of a stroke at the age of 56 in 1982. He started his career playing with Stan Kenton and Shorty Rogers. In 1950, he became addicted to heroin. 3 years later, he was imprisoned on a narcotics charge. He spent the better part of the next 13 years in prison, five of those years in San Quentin. In the late 60s, while he was in rehab at Synanon, he met a woman, also in recovery, who became his wife. Lori Pepper helped him resume his career and co-wrote his acclaimed autobiography, Straight Life. Now she's helping to reissue his recordings. The latest is a box set called the Hollywood All-Star Sessions. Before we ask Lori Pepper to talk about her late husband's life, let's listen to a track from the new box set. This is a 1980 recording of You Go to My Head, featuring Pete Jolly on piano, Bob Magnuson bass, Roy McCurdy drums. Lori Pepper helped Art Pepper reestablish his music career after he got out of rehab. I asked her some of the obstacles she faced in convincing clubs, booking agents, and record producers to take a chance and work with him.
This is interesting because when we moved in together after Synanon, we did it because we wanted to be together and because I wanted to work on the book, Straight Life, and I had no ambitions for him musically. And he, because he had none, or he seemed to have none. He was working as a bookkeeper at that time. And he thought that getting back into music would destroy him. And he was also very frightened of having to prove himself again. My God, I mean, the amount of energy and passion that he put into that, that ambition took out of him was, you know, it was pretty formidable. So he gave me the impression that he didn't want to play music anymore. And so a friend of his got some jobs for him doing bar mitzvahs and weddings, you know, and he was making his living doing that. And then somebody got him a job doing a clinic, a saxophone clinic at a college, or I think it was a clarinet clinic, the first one. And there was never any idea that he would be a musician again, touring. So that did not come from me. And it didn't come from him either. It came from outside.
Did you get advice from other women who were married to jazz musicians and who were managing or helping to manage their husbands' careers?
Yeah, and that happened around the Vanguard date, too. At that time, I didn't see. When we went on that tour and went to the Vanguard, I didn't know that that was going to be my role. I really didn't see myself as his manager or anything. I was just going along. And then I met Keiko Jones, Elvin Jones' wife. And during this horrendous experience, every evening, Keiko would lecture me about what to do, what to wear, how to act. And as I said in my afterword to Straight Life, how much power to take. And she said, all of it, all of it. And she was one tough lady. She used to set up Elvin's drums for him and order him around, this big, frightening guy. I mean, it was really something. So I learned a lot from Keiko. Also, Phil Wood's partner, Jill Goodwin, she came over to our house, and we talked for a while, and she was wonderful. She was telling me more of the practical aspects of managing. So I began to realize that that was going to be my job.
What did Keiko Jones tell you about what to wear?
Well, at that time, I was wearing jeans. I was wearing jeans and T-shirts. That's all I ever wore. And she told me I had to dress better. I had to look prosperous, and I had to look elegant. Well, that didn't bother me at all. And in a short time, I went out and bought a lot of expensive clothes. That was no problem for me.
And for whose sake should you have looked prosperous and elegant?
Oh, well, for art, you know, so that that people would recognize that he was important and that he made a lot of money and he had status and they would pay us a lot of money. And, you know, I think she was right.
Was it ever hard for you, as a woman married to a jazz musician, to get respect from other musicians or from club owners or whatever? Were you treated as an individual or as the wife?
Great question. I love that question. Nobody's ever asked me that question. Yes, it was horrible. Not always. Sometimes it was just great, and people treated me great. But there were other occasions where I would have to say, Art, will you come and tell this person that they have to listen to me, that I am speaking for you? And so he would. In Japan especially, you know, I mean, in Japan women are really invisible and beside the point. And so because I was in charge of the sound for the band, you know, and I was in charge of the sound guy in the various venues we went to when I learned the Japanese words for louder and softer and stuff like that, I mean, these guys would ignore me utterly. And some of them were kids, you know, a great deal younger than me, but I had to take Art by the hand with an interpreter, and he had to say, she is speaking for me. And it sometimes was rough. The other part that was rough was that Art would complain to me about things where he didn't like confrontations and he didn't like to complain. So I had to be the bad guy. So he would complain about something. For instance, he hated drummers to do double time during a ballad, but he wouldn't tell them that. I had to tell them that. And if I didn't tell them that, then they would play double time during a ballad. And if I did, they wouldn't believe me. So it was kind of, you know, it was, yes.
So that put you in the position sometimes, too, probably, of looking like the nag.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. I think I got kind of famous as being a real, you know, tiresome bitch. But, you know, I kind of liked it. All my life I'd been so nice.
Would he ask you about tunes that should be in his repertoire or get your impressions of his playing?
Yeah. He, poor guy, he did, and I told him. Generally, I would be the one who would compile the list of tunes for an individual set. He was usually too nervous beforehand to compile a good list. And what I would see him do is go out and play a whole bunch of tunes that were all pretty much the same kind of tune. And he agreed that there should be a variation. In fact, maybe it was even Keiko that told me that. I don't know. At any rate, so I began to be the one. I would give him a list of tunes. And he would show it to the guys, and that would be it. So he would do that. There were times when I would suggest that it would be wonderful if he would play a given tune. I would bring things home and play them for him. You know, yeah, there was a lot of that. That's part of what I was also talking about the respect that he gave me. You know, the fact that he would discuss these things with me as if I knew what I was talking about. It's pretty nice.
My guest is Lori Pepper. She's helping to reissue the recordings of her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Lori Pepper, we're talking about her late husband, alto saxophonist Art Pepper. Many of his recordings are getting reissued. This is from the reissue of his 1957 album, Art Pepper Meets the Rhythm Section. Like traveling with him, whether it was New York to play at the Vanguard or Tokyo to play concerts there. He was on methadone maintenance, and he was using other drugs as well. So what was it like when you were on the road?
Hell. It was like hell. When we traveled in Japan, I had to hide the methadone because no matter what, the fact that it was a prescription item for him didn't matter. They wouldn't let it into the country.
Methadone was illegal there?
Totally. Totally. We had a thing from the head of the Veterans Administration Hospital, and we were told, won't do you any good in Japan. You can't bring it in. So we had to hide it. I hid it in a shampoo bottle. Every time we went through any kind of checkout in any airport, and there were a lot of airports, I was shaking in my shoes that they would find it. In addition, I had to constantly monitor Art's use of it because if he could, he would take more than what he was supposed to. And I generally would have to hide it or lock it up or whatever. I've talked to women, lots of women who have been involved with men who are alcoholic or whatever, and I don't think I would have stuck it without that gift. The gift was there were a few things. The gift was one of them. The other thing was the way he treated me, which was very well. I mean, he gave me so much respect. He never criticized me. He thought I was terrific. He told everybody I was great. He wanted to believe that I was everything that he needed and told me that I was and told everybody else that I was, and so I did it. And that was a great learning experience for me, too, to find out what my capacities were.
There's one point in one of the sessions where he mentions you. This is an introduction.
Oh, that's not too nice. Yeah,
no, right. It's not. In fact, why don't I just play it here?
All right.
My last album, I was lucky enough to have recorded it with Elvin on drums and George Cables on piano and David Williams on bass, called Art Pepper the Trip on contemporary. And the record before that was called Art Pepper Living Legend with the late Hampton Hawes on piano, Charlie Hayden on bass, and Shelly Mann on drums. They're both for sale in the back by my wife. Wave your hand, baby. That pretty little, sweet little Jewish freak right there. That's my seventh woman. If I lose her, I'll go get an eighth. But I hope she don't leave me because I need her. Thank you. See you later.
That remark, which really was, that's about as low as he ever got. And the reason was this. He had been using the money. This was before I took control of the money, actually. He had been using the money that we had gotten to pay off a counselor at the methadone program in New York to buy extra methadone instead of using it to pay our hotel bill. I grabbed the money and paid the hotel bill with it. He was furious. I also said I was going to get that counselor in trouble. So he was very, very angry at me that night. But that's about as bad as it ever got. Usually, if you heard his comments on stage, he was lovely. He was lovely.
I'd like to play some more music from the Vanguard sessions that have just been released. And he plays Cherokee twice on this. The first time he plays it, he talks about how, you know, no jazz musician is worth anything if they can't play the heck out of this tune.
Mm-hmm.
And then he proceeds to burn through it.
Right.
We're going to hear the second version that he plays. What were your impressions of this performance?
When I realized that he was going to play Cherokee on that particular night where he was just so totally dissipated, I couldn't believe his nerve.
Because he takes it at such a fast pace?
Well, he always took it at a fast pace. I knew what he was going to do if he played Cherokee. And the idea that he believed that he could do that, that he could pull it off, there was no risk he would not take on stage. He was amazing. So my state was, he can't do it, number one, and number two, what nerve, what nerve. And then when I heard it, my God, he's doing it. He was a hell of a ride, you know.
Art Pepper, my guest, is Lori Pepper. Art Pepper's health was not good in the last years of his life.
No, it wasn't.
Was there a point where he assumed that he wouldn't live much longer?
I think he assumed he wouldn't live much longer when he was 10 years old, to tell you the truth. When I met him, he told me he wasn't going to live much longer. When I met him in Synanon, I mean, I think that was a refrain. I think he thought he had a limited time. And when he turned 50, I think he was utterly amazed. He was dumbfounded that he was still alive. He just could not believe it. So he thought that death was imminent. And when we began working on Straight Life, one of the first things he said is, I want to get this done because I know I'm dying. And yet he had 10 more years at that time.
Do you think that sense that, hey, I'm gonna die real soon, is one of the reasons why he kept going back to drugs? Because he just didn't think it would matter in the long run, because he didn't think there'd be an in the long run?
Yeah, I think that was, at least it was a good rationalization for him, that why shouldn't he get high? He didn't have that much longer. He should live the way he wanted to. And he had a lot of rationalizations for using drugs. But I think, you know, and the more I think about it, the more it seems to me to be the truth, that Art was so profoundly troubled emotionally. And whatever they're learning these days about brain chemistry or whatever, he was such a troubled soul, and he suffered so. He was so unbelievably sensitive to the stuff that most of us can deal with, that I think he was self-medicating all his life. I think he was just trying to ease the pain, and because things were more real to him than they are to the rest of us. Things were so intense to him. And so he had a lot of rationalizations, but I think in the long run, it was the only way he could live.
Did he die in a lot of pain?
No. No, he didn't. He died insofar as it's possible to know you're dying and have it be an easy death. He died with very little pain. He had a cerebral hemorrhage. We didn't know it. He had a headache. And he never, never had headaches. I get migraines, but he never had headaches. And so I took him to the doctor, and it happened very quickly after that. But he knew he was dying. He told me in the car as I was driving him to the hospital, and he said he wanted me to know that he'd had a good life, and he wanted to thank me for what I had done. He felt that he'd done everything that he had to do. I told you that when the odds were against him, he rose to the occasion. And I can't think of any more difficult occasion than your own death. He was beautiful. You know, he was amazing, amazingly courageous. And he said all these things. And then we were in the hospital, and he was lying there on the table, and his entire left side became paralyzed. And he told me, "You don't know how scared I am." And I just started hugging him and kissing him. And he said, "That's what I need. I need love." And he was, you know, he did the hardest things so well. And he died well. And but he knew he was dying for so long. It was not a surprise. It was what he'd been waiting for.
Did you have a sense that he really wanted his music to live on after his death? That what happened to his music after his death was very important?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's this great... I was listening to some tape, live performance of his at some nightclub, and he gave this fantastic performance of something, and the audience was just screaming and yelling. And Art said into the microphone, he said, "That just goes to show, you know." He said, "That goes to show that you can cheat death. You can cheat death." And I just shivered when I heard that, because that's what he was up to.
Lori Pepper, recorded in 1996. She's just produced a box set of her late husband's recordings called Art Pepper, The Hollywood All-Star Sessions. Coming up, Henry Sheehan reviews the new movie, Our Song. This is Fresh Air. The Jackie Robinson Steppers Marching Band is made up of Brooklyn youth aged 8 to 18. After watching one of their performances in a New York City parade, filmmaker Jim McKay decided to incorporate the band into the screenplay he was writing about three 15-year-old girls from Crown Heights. The result is Our Song, which film critic Henry Sheehan calls one of the most remarkable American movies of the year.
Lanisha, Maria, and Joycelyn are three teenage girls who've been fast friends for nearly all their lives. At age 15, they go to the same school and are members of the same community marching band, the Jackie Robinson Steppers, a delightful conglomeration that specializes in sharp beats and cool steps. They don't have any reason to think that they won't be friends forever, but during one summer, somehow they drift apart. Out of what to American ears may sound like flimsy material, director Jim McKay has fashioned a small, heartbreaking masterpiece with Our Song. While taking in all sorts of social realities that most movies usually miss, McKay has kept his focus intensely personal. This isn't a movie, say, about three black and Hispanic girls, poverty and pregnancy. It's about Lanisha, Maria, and Joycelyn, whose indelible humanity lives on long after the final credits fade from the screen. Naturally, within any trio of friends, tensions are bound to emerge, especially in the rumpus of adolescence. But it sometimes takes an outside force to bring those tensions to the surface. In the girls' case, it's the news that their high school will be closed for the upcoming year for asbestos removal, and they may end up in different schools. If the girls were going to stick together, maybe it wouldn't matter that Joycelyn has been hanging out a little bit with a couple of slightly more sophisticated girls, or that Lanisha and Maria, who have some Hispanic blood, have been speaking Spanish to each other as a way of communicating secretly in front of boys, a joke that English-only Joycelyn can't join. In this scene, the three crowd together in Lanisha's tiny bedroom in her family's project apartment. They're still bound by the intimacies of childhood, sprawling into each other unselfconsciously, sharing daydreams, idle chatter, and ice cream. But if you listen carefully, you hear quiet cracks of separation.
Me, Keisha, and Cammy went to this ice cream store. I got this flavor mochaccino. It's like chocolate and coffee. I gotta taste that one. It is so good.
I never heard of that one.
It sounds good.
He was with Keisha and Kim?
You went after practice the other day. You were busy doing push-ups.
Good one, Miss Mocarino.
Mucacino. It's like chocolate and coffee. Like you, Lanisha. Mucacino.
I'm sweet. Thank you. Café con leche con azúcar. ¿Y qué es el helado de María?
They need to be having some beans and rice ice cream. Because that'd be her flavor.
Frijoles y arroz con crema. Es el primero helado. Muy bueno. Muy frío.
I don't even know what y'all even saying in Spanish.
Joycelyn, you are like chocolate with a vanilla swirl.
Nuh-uh. Girl, please. I'm full on chocolate. What are you talking about? Dark chocolate.
No, mocha. Yo, mocha.
McKay employs a number of subtle strategies to make his film so ardently honest, but they wouldn't have done any good if he didn't have the actresses to play the three girls. Kerry Washington, Melissa Martinez, and Anna Simpson, who play Lanisha, Maria, and Joycelyn, are so good that at times Our Song seems like a documentary. But while all three girls did grow up in New York City neighborhoods often described as troubled, they are actresses, not stand-ins. Washington, who gives the movie's most amazing performance, is highly trained and experienced. She played Julia Stiles' best friend in the undistinguished Save the Last Dance. Oddly enough, Our Song can be praised exactly as an anti-Save the Last Dance, free of plot contrivances and letting the characters dictate the action rather than the other way around. Our Song is not so intimate that it excludes the Crown Heights community at large. The dauntingly tall projects, the hot, oil-stained streets, and the jostling neighbors are all there. So, too, are some of the traps that catch even the wariest girls, including pregnancy. But McKay avoids the trap of treating pregnancy as a larger social problem for poor people, even when one of the girls discovers she's going to have a baby. What matters is how she feels and what she's going to do. Finally, you wouldn't want to miss the Robinson Steppers, who, along with their charismatic leader, Tyrone Brown, play themselves in the movie. After all the practices, you begin to thirst for a full-bore performance. Don't worry. McKay doesn't let you down there, either.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Our Song is playing in New York and L.A. and will open in more cities on June 29th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shirok. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Dell Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from airline hell to a new age of air travel, we talk with James Fallows. His new book, Free Flight, is about an emerging alternative to large crowded planes and jammed up hubs, small high-tech jets that operate like air taxis. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.